Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the Technology.ie podcast, episode 27 for May 2nd, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Hello and welcome to technology.ie. This is Conor Muinichon with you in the Edgecast Media Studio, and we're joined as usual by Michaela Nealon on Skype. Hi Michaela.
Hi Conor, how's it going?
Not in your office, not at home. Where are you tonight?
I'm en route to New York. I'm actually up in the Hilton in Dublin near Dublin Airport.
Flying out tomorrow morning. What's on in New York?
A few business meetings, and I'm also going to the Ireland Fund dinner.
That's
President Michael D. Higgins will be the guest of honour.
Very good. That's a big occasion. How many are expected at that?
I'm not sure in the exact figures, but I know it's like the event of the year for the Irish American community in New York.
So
there's a lot of, you know, people going to be there from the Irish American community.
We're going to talk about, actually, speaking of networking, I want to talk a bit this evening about the Dublin Beta event that was on last night in Dublin. We're going to talk about Nokia's troubles and Samsung's success on the show this evening. Also going to talk about Google Maps. They're now going to allow you to have a street view inside somebody's shop. The Referendum Commission have launched a Facebook page and app to help you register to vote, and there's a lot of other good stuff as well. This is the story I want to start with, though, and it relates to Google. Google engineer behind WiSpy outed by the New York Times. Did you see that, Michele?
Yeah, well, I was following that story on and off for the last couple of weeks. Mm. And, you know, the entire thing was, you know, was it done intentionally? Was it accidental? You know, what was going on? Were Google up to no good? And it sounds like, you know, several people knew it wasn't. And it wasn't really an accident. And they actually got fined, what was it, $25,000 or something?
Now that fine, Michele, it's important to clarify, wasn't for any kind of wrongdoing. I think it was the Federal Trade Commission that issued that fine. But it was for what they perceived as a lack of cooperation from Google in relation to the investigation. They felt that Google was slow in responding and had difficulty giving them emails and names and whatever they asked for in relation to their investigation. But they didn't actually find any wrongdoing. And do you remember, Michele, I mean, this was a worldwide issue. It was an issue for data protection authorities in countries all over the world. One of the most interesting responses was, I think, the Irish Data Protection Commissioner's response, if you recall. They considered it, investigated it, and they said to Google, right, just delete the data and don't do it again.
You know, the data that they were able to collect, you know, it opens a big moral thing. You know, just because you can access it, should you access it? I think this is something that a lot of technology companies are going to have to struggle with, and I mean, a lot of users are going to have to struggle with as well. Because I think part of the problem is that, you know, if a Wi-Fi network isn't locked down, then people can get quite a bit of data from it. But, you know, just because it's not locked down, is that giving you permission to enter it? I think the answer is probably no.
You see, Google were using this data to get location-aware information, just as they do with GPS or whatever. They can get location information from the how close you are to a particular access point. That's all fine and grand, but they don't need the actual unencrypted emails and data that people have sent over that Wi-Fi access point in order to provide location information. That's going too far, isn't it?
Well, this is the entire thing. It's that if you turn on any Wi-Fi enabled device and get it just to, you know, see what Wi-Fi networks are available that it can see, you'll see a whole load of Wi-Fi networks. I mean, you won't connect to them if they're password protected, but you'll see them and they're there, and that supposedly helps with improving location data. Mm. But when you start actually sniffing packets of data off an unencrypted connection, That is going a little bit too far. I mean, it's one thing, I suppose, if it just kind of traverses, if it just you happen to pick it up as you're doing something else and you don't keep it, you just dump it. Mm. But, I mean, if you look at the data retention directive and, you know, the obligations on ISPs and hosting providers around that, one of the really sticking points was that the content of the emails, the content of the communications, we were not allowed to look at. Mm. You know, you're allowed to, and we're expected to, retain data around the connections themselves. So, for example, if you were sending an email from your computer to me, then you know, there's various connections along the way and various people would have access to that data. But the actual content of the email you're sending me, that's private.
When this came to light, Google themselves, as we know, are the people who brought it to light publicly. They put their hands up and said, we've collected this data. They reported it to the data protection authorities in various jurisdictions, including Ireland, as we said. And they said, you know, we didn't mean to collect this data, and that's fine. But this report in the New York Times is interesting because they identified the engineer who wrote the software. And it turns out he's a bit of a serious Wi-Fi hacker who actually is the author of a program which would be well familiar to anyone who's ever done war driving using a Windows laptop, for example. And the program I'm talking about is NetStumbler. The guy's name is Milner, Marius Milner. He's been identified by the New York Times. He declined to speak to the New York Times and, in fact, pleaded the Fifth Amendment when he was questioned by federal investigators in the States as well. Didn't want to say anything which might in any way incriminate him. But NetStumbler, have you ever done war driving, Michaela, yourself, driving around looking for access points?
No. Personally, no. I mean, a lot of my friends have.
There was a phase of it. It's kind of passé now, but it was a thing about 10 years ago, was it not?
Well, I think part of it was because at the time, you know, internet connections were so expensive.
Yeah.
Even if you had an internet connection, it might have been, you know, pretty slow and pathetic. So if you could go drive up to, you know, outside some big office where they had a decent connection and leech some of their bandwidth.
Yeah.
That was the kind of thing that I think a lot of people were trying to do. I mean, obviously others were doing much more nefarious things, but I think that was the simple attraction. And also, I suppose,
What I had used it for, in fact, was an entirely legitimate purpose and one with which anyone, I think, who is trying to provide broadband in rural areas would be familiar with. And that was working with various DIY. There was a group based here in the Midwest of Ireland called Irish WAN. They've been active in various other parts of the country as well. Again, mostly voluntary. A lot of companies actually spun out from this, wireless internet service providers as well, people providing services commercially. And there's some great guys I know that, in fact, provided me myself with a DIY solution through which I ran my home and business in quite a rural area for well over a year and a half, 2 years, before we got some form of DSL. It's still not as good as it could be. But this was something, in fact, that was used as a practical tool in relation to this, that you would have various people would put up access points on high ground, on mountains, on hills, on tall buildings, things like that, broadcasting in all directions or perhaps in one direction in particular with high gain antenna. 802.11 wireless Wi-Fi, essentially. But you can get signals. In fact, in the signal I was using at one point, we were getting a 1 megabit signal. Nothing fantastic, but better than nothing else. We were getting it over 20 miles.
Yeah, well, it was something. I mean, I know Paul, our CTO, my business partner, was quite active in that entire area going back a couple of years. I mean, we even considered launching a wireless ISP a few years ago.
We looked
into it. We ran the numbers. We spent quite a bit of time investigating all the ins and outs. And the main problem we had in terms of the feasibility, when we looked at it, was the customer access equipment.
Yes.
Like the device, the router, the whatever you want to call it, that you put in somebody's home or office. And the problem we had was that, you know, if you were talking about using unlicensed spectrum, so it was completely open, anybody could sell services off it or use it or whatever. And the equipment at the time, I'm trying to remember the exact figure, but I think it worked out at 500 or 600 euro a pop for the devices, and that's where it started making very little sense.
Yeah,
because you'd either you'd end up subsidizing the hardware, which meant that, you know, you'd have to keep a client for I don't know how many years to pay it off, or you had to charge a huge setup fee.
Yes.
So either way, it just didn't really work for us. I think now it might be feasible. If you look at, say, the WRT 54Gs and shove some open source software on that, it will probably work.
Be interested to hear from people who are active, perhaps in war driving or in, well, probably not so much anymore, or in WISPs or in DIY solutions like that. What's the current state of the art on that? You know the way it is, when you look into something like this at one point or another, you become very well up on it, very familiar with what the latest technology is on that, and then not so much anymore. In particular, I imagine there's less, well, yeah, probably less going on with, I suppose for urban war driving, you'd probably use an iPad or an app on an Android or an iOS phone, perhaps now is what you'd use, rather than going around with a laptop on the car seat beside you. Certainly, I think you'd still need a laptop if you're going around with the Pringles tube. Did you ever see that? That's one of the things they used to talk about, and that you could get a directional antenna, make it yourself, in fact, out of a Pringles tube, and use it for going around and figuring out what you could find in particular directions. It's interesting. If there's anyone out there who's has been or is still actively involved in that, we'd certainly love to hear from you at technology.ie. Let's move on a little bit, Michele, and this is related, I think, really to the Google Maps war driving and Street View. They are now inviting businesses to, if you have a department store or a large shop or anything like that, they're inviting you to get in touch with one of a number of photographers that they have nominated, who can produce a 360-degree panoramic photograph that is suitable for display on Google Street View. And they're going to actually extend that, basically, so you can walk in off the street virtually and take a look around somebody's shop. This has been available in the States for a while. They're now expanding it out to Europe and to Ireland, included in that as well, to give businesses the opportunity to do that. It's the logical progression, I suppose, Michele, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the kind of, it sounds like it would work very well for restaurants and hotels. Hmm. Just looking at it, just thinking, those are the ones that would strike me as having the most to gain from something like that. I mean, I can't see, would you really want to have a look inside a supermarket?
I mean,
you know, you see one supermarket, you've seen them all. But maybe for shops that are selling, shops and businesses where it's not just what they're selling, it's also how they sell it, how they display it, the entire kind of atmosphere and everything else. I can see that as being attractive, because I mean, it's not free. I mean, they expect you, the business, to pay for the photos.
We'll move on, Michele, and this one is cool. Just announced today, in fact, the Referendum Commission here in Ireland have launched a Check the Register and Vote Facebook page and an app which you can actually click on, and it will take you directly to your own county council, and you can check your name and address and see if you are on the register. It's pretty good, isn't it?
No.
No? Not impressed?
No, and it's not actually their fault. I tried it out because, yeah. I don't know, somebody mentioned it, or maybe I saw a link to it, I don't know. I came across, I think it was yesterday, and the main problem is, while they might be able to do funky things on Facebook and do an integration of some sorts there, they still haven't fixed the Check the Register website, and it still sucks. It sucks big time. I mean, right. I can't find myself, and I'm always able to vote. And I mean, in some elections in the past, I've had multiple votes available to me.
Vote early and often.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, as you know, I've moved around the country, so I've had I've had multiple votes in my native Cork, and I've had votes in Carlow, and I even had votes in Limerick. But the main problem is that the actual Check the Register website itself sucks. It sucks really, really badly. So you can kind of go, oh well, that's great, that's wonderful, I can check the register, and it might do certain things. But the problem is, when you actually go to check the register itself, you're stuck. It doesn't tell you. It doesn't automatically select when you go from the Facebook app. It doesn't automatically select your province or anything like that.
You'll okay.
do that.
Yeah, I get it. So in fact, what they're offering on Facebook here is nothing more than a link to the checktheregister.ie website.
Basically.
Yeah. Which, but again, I followed the link. I click, click, click. Choose your county. County Clare, in my case, no problem at all. I guess it depends on your county council then as well, in terms of what kind of how well integrated this service is. But I mean, okay, there was a bit of clicking involved, a little bit of typing. But
no, I mean, look, I'm not knocking it, just in the sense of that it's terrible.
But they could have done more.
Well, they could have done more if the data was accessible via an API.
Right.
So let's say the CRO, for example. The CRO recently launched an API, so now you can access company and business information programmatically. So if you want to, do any number of different things using company information, there is an accessible API. I mean, up until they launched that, you had to go through a third party if you wanted access to the data in a manner other than what was presented on the website.
So when I described this as at the start as a Facebook app, it is nothing of the kind. You could not write a Facebook app unless there was an API for this data.
Well, yeah, basically. I mean, you're limited by what it's interfacing with.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I think it's, and look, it's a move in the right direction. I mean, the thing is this, I mean, you would have to be completely, I think I have to work on my inner voice here, don't I? Stop calling people idiots. you'd have to be crazy to ignore the importance of Facebook and other social media. I mean, if you want to reach somebody, running an ad in a newspaper may or may not reach them. But if you want to reach, as particularly those people who traditionally don't vote, then going on to Facebook, I think, is a very good way to do it, because that's where they all hang out.
Yeah, I liked it and I shared it this evening, not because I think a lot of my friends don't vote, but personally, as I found, it can be nice in the virtual world to get a nudge about something that you have to check in the real world. It's a way that it'll reach you perhaps that it wouldn't reach you in any other way, And you can, when you're sitting at a PC, you can check the register, you can go and do that. Whereas if you're perhaps driving in your car listening to a radio ad, you may make a mental note to check it later, but not actually do it.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, it'll be interesting to see how this takes off. I mean, so far, what time is it now? Whatever time of night it is now, we won't say because it's ridiculously late. There are only 28 people have liked the page.
Right.
That is not exactly
stellar.
No. No.
Well, I've done my bit and I liked it and shared it tonight. We'll move on, Michaela. There's a lot we want to talk about this evening, but I want to talk about Black Knight Solutions, your company, your business, and the sponsor, of course, of technology.ie. You're still hiring and advertising a range of positions now. That information is still available on your website at blackknight.com.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, we advertise all of the open positions on technicaljobs.ie. Several of them we've advertised on adverts.ie because they now have a job board there as well, which is, of course, part of boards.ie. And we've also run ads on Recruit Ireland. But interestingly enough, yesterday we announced another vacancy of customer service and technical support. And we got loads of CVs in within a few hours, which was fantastic. So other stuff we're at, we're still doing the GoMobi promo, so you can get a 30-day free trial of the mobile website builder. The really, really big news for this week, and I'd say go further and say for this month, even maybe for this year, is that Nominet, the registry for co.uk, org.uk and net.uk, have finally launched multi-year registration. So what that means is, Con, you can now register or renew your co.uk domain name for up to 10 years. Because up until yesterday... Well, yesterday you couldn't. You could only register a co.uk for two years, and that was it. Mm. Now you can register a co.uk domain for any period for between 1 year and 10 years. For me, this is fantastic because I've got several co.uk domain names that I paid significantly more than the registration fee, and being able to renew those domains for the maximum period possible, I mean, I'll sleep better tonight. I mean, I actually will. I will actually. It was one less worry because I don't have to worry about those domain names expiring or whatever. I've got them renewed. Like some of them now are renewed through for the next 10 years, And it's great. I'm really happy.
Very good. So you can find out more about that as well on the website at blackknight.com. And indeed, there's a post you've put up there at blog.blackknight.com. The other thing you wanted to mention this week, Michele, is that Black Knight are sponsoring the IIIA annual conference. We had Joan Mulville, of course, on the show a couple of months ago, and she did mention the conference coming up. What date is that on?
That's on the 10th.
10th of May.
On the 10th of May. And, you know, the thing is, you know, Joan talked to us about that, whatever that was a couple of months back. Mm. And at the time, you know, we've been involved with the Irish Internet Association for years. And, you know, we sponsored a bit in the past and we've gone a few times. And things. I think, you know, it's good to be involved with these kind of things. And, you know, Joan's doing a stellar job.
Excellent. The theme of enabling business expansion, and they're going to talk about social media, localization and mobile, and building bricks is the title. There's a reference there, I presume, to the emerging markets of Brazil, Russia, India, China and that as well. But it's tickets, I presume, are still available, are they, for the conference for next
year? Yeah, they are. I'm not sure how the ticket sales are going, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
And in the blog post, we'll have a coupon code that people can use that will give them a discount.
Oh, excellent. So that's the place to go if you're thinking of going first to the IIA annual conference. It's on Thursday of next week, the 10th of May. Stop by technology.ie, first of all, to pick up your coupon code for that.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to technology.ie, the podcast sponsored by Black Knight and brought to you and presented each week by myself, Conor Muinichon, and Black Knight CEO, Michele Nealon. Michele, let's talk about Dublin Beta. It was on last night. It's a quarterly gathering and a social occasion and networking opportunity for people in the startup and high-tech industry in Dublin. I'm a long way from Dublin. You're really only on Dublin's doorstep, of course. Do you go to many events like this?
To be perfectly honest, no, I don't. Because the problem these days is, you know, it takes about an hour and a half to get into Dublin. A lot of the events might start at, say, 7 o'clock in the evening or possibly before then. Mm. So, you know, for me, it's you know, I have to kind of make a big night of it, go up and stay, because if I don't stay, I can't have a drink or anything. And really enjoy it. So I mean, I do go up for something, but I don't go up for that many.
Yeah. There's a good report now. I'm quoting from a report by Silicon Republic on this, and they did a good report on last night's event. Five companies showcased at it. It's one of those things where they go around and you go around at the pub or the bar or whatever it is, and people are showcasing their site or their startup on a laptop or their service or whatever it may be, and you get a chip and you can vote with your chips as to what the favourite is. The people's favourite on the night was one called Bullet HQ. Interestingly enough, Bullet HQ was featured on the other show that I'm involved with, the Small Business Show, and there's an interview. We'll put a link into that interview as well. What it is online accounts, basically, and there's a lot of services like that out there. There's one called Sort My Books that is based on in Kerry that I've used in the past. These guys, Peter Connor and John Farrelly, said they built their product for just 1,400 euros. Now, I don't know where the developers themselves is. There are a lot of free work put in from their point of view as well. But it's basically an online accounting system. That's really something of value, really, to SMEs, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we use an online accounting system as well, and have done for several years. And it's just, you know, there's lots of different ones. I mean, there's very, from the very simple ones which just allow you to do invoicing all the way through to, you know, full accounting packages. And, you know, I think for a lot of companies these days, you know, you're not going to have necessarily an accountant or a CFO or something like that working for you full time. You probably take your accounts to a third party, you know, once a year or a few times throughout the year. But what a lot of companies like ourselves have been doing, I think, is, you know, doing it so that you input all the data on a regular basis, be that daily or weekly or whatever, and then you're able to get fairly up-to-date reporting within a couple of days of the end of the month, which is which is what you need. But you need to know where you're at.
You absolutely do, yeah. And I mean, even for smaller businesses, even than your own, Michaela, it's very useful to have that kind of those kind of services available. Things like invoicing and quotes and things like that, and being able to manage all those with an online system is very, very useful indeed as well. And you don't have to worry about backing up your accounts data on a regular basis either. I had used a desktop system previously, and it was something you had to be very careful about as well. Didn't take a lot to back it up, but you had to make sure that you actually did. You wanted to talk about Kickstarter.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I mean, it's one of these things. I mean, I've come across Kickstarter a few times over the last few months. Now, they were in the news again in the last few days. And it's one of those things where, you know, you're talking about crowdsourcing funding.
Yes.
As you remember that app we talked about a couple of weeks back, the one where you have the, you know, the totally immersive experience, the Zombie Run app.
That's right. Have you tried it yet?
No.
I'm going to nag you until you do.
If I told you all the things that I've you know, signed up for and done over the years for various different things, not just kind of losing weight or getting fit, you know, I should be ashamed of myself. But okay, let's face it, I'm not.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's do it together, Michaela. I'm fascinated by the zombie app, and I think I'll try it myself. And I might. I wonder, can you share scores or compete against people and how they do on it as well? If there was that element of it,
I don't think that's there yet. But yeah. The thing was that they managed to get their funding through Kickstarter or one of those type things. And you're talking about, you know, crowdsourcing funding. So instead of going and looking for one or two investors or a loan from a bank or whatever, which can be quite hard to get, especially in the current climate, you're looking at a system where, you know, lots of people throw in, you know, relatively small amounts of money. Mm. But what's interesting is that it's only those who have really viable, really, well, seemingly viable concepts that actually make the money. And
are at least doing the public vote. So you're kind of, you're crowdsourcing, using the wisdom of crowds to actually vet these proposals, and the ones that actually get the public support are perhaps have something going for them.
Well, this is it. Because one of the problems, and this is something that we ran into a few years ago, and I think a lot of people have run into, is, you know, there are supports available, there are grants, there are various things that you can apply for. But a lot of the time, you end up, you know, it takes you way longer and much, much more hard work to put together a good application than it would do to, you know, just, you know, build it, sell stuff and get money in.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, Damien actually had an interesting post on this up on his blog earlier during the week there.
Damien Molly, we'll put a link into this as well, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing is, and it's something I think a few people disagree about, and I'm just reading you quickly here. This quick note, more than a blog post. I'd like to see anyone that wants to draw down government funds have to prove themselves by doing a Kickstarter-type drive. We hear about embracing failure and have the war scars from previous startups can be a good thing, and sometimes something VCs might want to see. I know he just goes on a little bit. I mean, he doesn't go into a huge amount of details. As he said, it was more of a note than an actual post. I know there's another one already out there for companies and, well, organizations in the arts, Fundit, at fundit.ie. And there isn't really anything like that in the tech space.
Is Kickstarter tech or arts related? It I think there is a criteria that you have to be somehow arts related in relation to Kickstarter. I've just opened it up here. The categories are art, comics, dance, design, fashion, film and video. Oh, food is in there. Games, music, photography, publishing, technology. No, you're right. It does everything. It does.
It does everything. I mean, there's probably, if you do, you can do a search. You can search by location. You can search or browse by category, and you know what's it? You know, they have their staff who do. If you look onto the site, you know, there'll be staff picks. Mm. You can. It'll also does a pretty cool thing where it uses your computer's location to bring up projects that it thinks are close to you physically.
Right.
So, for example, it thought I was in the UK a minute ago. Now it's decided I'm in Carlow. I don't know. I'm actually in neither, but hey, so it's not showing me anything. But, you know, they set a limit as, you know, this is the amount of money we need to get. Mm. And what's been kind of interesting to watch is how some of the
some of these projects, you know, they might say, hey, we need 50,000, let's say, as a number, and they might get 10 million or this kind of craziness, you know, or there's other ones where they only want a small amount of money and they're really struggling. But it's, you know, it's really, it is, you know, the idea of the intelligence of the crowd, as opposed to how charming you or well connected you might be, or how well you've put together those PowerPoint slides or whatever.
Yeah,
so I think, you know, it's an interesting one.
And Damien is proposing that this really should be a feature or an element of anyone who's applying for any kind of government grant in relation to enterprise, that from the enterprise boards or Enterprise Ireland, that there should be some kind of an element like this that would sort of ensure the quality, perhaps, of some of these proposals, and make sure that the grants are going to somebody who has, at least in the view of the Kickstarter-type community, got something viable going.
Well, this is it. Yeah. I mean, you know, you look at, say, Dragon's Den or The Apprentice or any of these things. I mean, you look at the ones, the Irish one, you look at the ones in the UK, or you look at, what's it called in the US? Shark something?
I don't know
the name of it. It's something. It's the same thing as Dragon's Den. They've just got a different name for it. And you know, the quality of of some of the projects is pretty high, but others, you know, they're probably on there more for the comedy factor than anything else, which is, you know, a terrible thing to say, but you know, there is a certain degree of reality. But then you look at some of the success stories, like that guy with the reggae sauce in the UK. I mean, that was amazing.
Let's move on, Michele. I want to talk about SEO, and that we've got a clip coming up from an interview I did this week with David Quaid of Primary Position, which is one of Ireland's foremost SEO consultancies. We'll talk about that in a little while and get your thoughts on it. But I just want to briefly refer to this story: SNP downgrades Nokia to junk. Rating agency Standard & Poor's recently downgraded the credit rating of Nokia to BB+ from BBB-. I love these ratings. The rating agency has also downgraded the company's short-term credit rating, and with this downgrade, Nokia's debt now falls under the junk category, which is a notch lower than its previous investment grade rating of BBB-, as we say. And then I'm contrasting that with a story linking to the Irish Times here. Samsung net income jumps 81% to $3.36 billion. They're two very stark contrasts. Recently, Michele, we got a press release, for example, recently about Nokia introducing a new, something similar to the Silk browser that Amazon have, for example, in the Kindle and Kindle Fire at the moment. Nokia have introduced a similar kind of technology recently for their Series 40 devices. And my reaction when I thought of this is, Series 40? Who cares about this nowadays? Who cares about Nokia's OS? Who cares about Symbian? Who cares about these feature phones? This market is dead and dying, and Nokia has not moved fast enough to get into the smartphone market, even despite their recent launch of the latest, is it the Lumia 900 or 800? Lumia 900, I think it is. Again, I almost don't care their alliance with Windows. And, you know, I'm not saying it's too late for Nokia, but it really has been a spectacularly slow response to the iPhone revolution, hasn't it?
Well, okay, there's a couple of things here. I mean, first of all, let's look back. Let's stand back for a second. Let's take a trip down memory lane, because we're both old enough to remember these things.
Do you remember when Nokia was a toilet paper company?
No, I'm not that old.
Do you remember Twink and Jonathan Ryan and Jumbo's toilet tissue?
Yeah.
Yes, and at the end was the tagline on these ads, made by Nokia. And that's what Nokia was famous for back in the 1980s. But go on, Michele. They then, there's no denying the success of what they did with these giant Scandinavian corporations. Okay, so there's usually...
Yeah, but the thing is this, Colin. Look, exactly. Yeah. Look, listen, come on now.
Yeah, you do the talking, though.
Calm down a second.
All right, then. Okay.
Look, take Apple, right? Apple is the perfect example. Apple was a massive success for a short period of time, and then practically vanished.
Practically disappeared.
Remember that? Practically disappeared.
Yeah.
And everybody had given up on Apple. Apple was passé. Mm. Nobody cared. You used to see Apple computers gathering dust in the corner, and you know, maybe people working in graphic design or print were still using them, But there was no mass market for them whatsoever.
And then Steve Jobs came back like Moses and led them to the promised land.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I remember years back, I mean, back, oh, this must be sometime in the early 80s, going to, I think it was the Ideal Homes exhibition in Cork or something like that. Well, you know. And Apple had a big stand, because, yeah, of course, Apple is based in Cork. And, hey, did you hear that? They're hiring another, what was it, 500 people?
In Cork?
Yep.
Cool.
That was news last, I think it was about a week ago. And at the time, this was around the time when they were, you know, they were on the up and up, before they disappeared completely. Mm. And you had this entire thing about, you know, IBM, Big Blue, and all this kind of thing, you know, coming down from the mountain to take on Apple. Mm. And if you remember the adverts they were running, remember all that. Remember how it wasn't Nokia that dominated mobile phones originally. It was Motorola.
That's right.
Then Motorola didn't innovate fast enough. Mm. Nokia took over. Mm. And Nokia used to have the cool phone. Come on, do you remember the Matrix phone?
I do, and I remember, I mean, there was definitely, and I would have gone through a series of phones, and I would have had, you know, Motorola was the phone to have. Ericsson was the phone to have at one point as well. And, you know, definitely Nokia, there's no question about it. Everyone had a Nokia. We were all standardized on Nokia, and it became a self-fulfilling thing. People just wanted, when their phone stopped working, they said, give me more of the same. And that's perfect.
That was it. I mean, I think it was the 6310 and the 6310i.
But how far are we into now the iPhone era, Michele, which they have had made absolutely no serious effort to challenge, I have to say. I mean, you go into your shop.
They failed so far.
What are you saying so, Michele? Are you saying they can come back, that they can recover from this?
Well, I just say that, I mean, the reality is that Nokia and other phones and other companies like that, that may not have innovated as fast in, you know, the smartphone space, there's still hope for them. And don't forget as well that, you know, for lots of Africa, and you look at the size of Africa in reality, if you look at that, there was an image floating around Facebook over the last couple of days actually showing Africa proportional to the rest of the world. In a lot of countries in Africa, mobiles are the only way people access the internet. And the bandwidth they have isn't exactly fantastic. So smartphones have no market. I mean, they have some market, but not much.
Yeah, but
so, you know, there's still a big market there.
Yeah, but if the cost of if you compare smartphones and tablets perhaps to the cost of PCs or netbooks, which of course is an obsolete kind of category now, there was a brief flourishing of that. But if you compare, if you want to look for something perhaps more than a phone, where you're going to go in the developing countries is not to Nokia, and it's not to Apple either. It's to the proliferation of Android devices, cheapest chips, and a pretty good, you know, user experience across the board.
Oh yeah, no, I don't know. I agree. I mean, like I get press releases from Nokia's PR company. I mean, nothing to do with technology.ie. For some reason, I ended up on their press list. And, you know, I used to just read their announcements, that I get one once every couple of weeks. Mm. You know, Nokia announced the availability of something. And I'd kind of go, why do I care? I mean, yeah. Why would I bother telling anybody about this?
It's another one to put out there to the listeners as well. If you think we should care, if we're missing something here, please do let us know. If you're a Windows Phone fan or a Nokia fan or an expert on mobile devices, please do let us know, because we'd like to know more. Before we finish up this week's podcast, Michele, I just want to refer a kind of a little bit of cross-pollination to, as you know, I do another show called The Small Business Show. Normally, there isn't a whole lot of overspill between technology.ie and The Small Business Show, but there is this week, because this week we published an interview with David Quaid, whom many people in Ireland in the tech community will know as Primary Position. That's his company name. It's also his Twitter handle as well. And David is one of a number of people in the country who are involved in search engine optimization. David and I had an interesting chat. It's the full podcast, in fact, is 22 minutes long, and I'll put a link in if anyone wants to listen to it. But for the audience of technology.ie, there isn't really much there. We cover a lot of the basics of SEO 101 for people and what kind of things small business should consider. For example, you made an interesting point that you should really consider your domain name first. Before you even build a site, you should consider how you're going to market it, which is again, good practice in business in general. Your first step has got to be, who's going to buy this? Who's going to want to find this or whatever it might be? But I'm just going to play you a clip.
Just before you get into that.
Yes.
No, it's one of the things about choosing domain names, Calm, that I think we probably should look at again more closely. Because there's been several threads on a number of bulletin boards over the last few weeks that I've seen where, you know, people are talking about, you know, I've got this idea for something and, you know, I found a domain that's available, but there's another company that has a domain that's quite similar. Am I going to run into trouble? These kind of conversations. And it's an interesting area.
Without a doubt. This particular clip that I'm going to play features David in response to a question I asked him about whether or not you can game the search engine results or whether or not you can do link farming or things like that. Basically, David goes on to explain that really, in practice, you can't do that. Google are constantly combating that. And the best way to do it, really, is to play it straight and to offer meaningful content to your users and indeed to the search engine as well.
Google is constantly trying to fight this battle. They've got algorithms and patented algorithms for discovering if site A links to B and B links to C and D. You know, so it's not, they're well aware of A to B linking. You know, we all get these emails every day saying, you know, my site looks like it could link to yours. Can you put a link back to me? Any page with 100 links will be passing absolutely no authority because the authority is divided by the number of links on a page. So straight away, if you see that type of practice, you can be pretty sure it's a wasted effort. Google famously launched their Panda update last year, so they can launch an update every 2 weeks, every couple of days, but the big one was Panda, and that destroyed so many of these link farms and content farms because they're not adding value to people. You know, the types of pages that these are on, they're pretty much illegible to a human being. They offer no value and they don't connect anybody. And it's slightly narcissistic in a way. You can build a very, very strong web presence, a very good brand without resorting to any of those tactics at all.
So what kind of tactics should you employ? Now, you mentioned that you should try and see if you can get links from other people. So those people should be relevant. What else should you do?
Well, certainly you can then, you know, take your website and promote it in other places. For example, having it connected properly on your LinkedIn, having a blog on your website is a great way of promoting it because it allows engagement. So, for example, if you're discussing, you know, particularly for professionals and service providers, if you're debating things that are happening in politics, for example, health and safety, the HSE, you know, medical treatments and things like that, if you can run a commentary and show people the insight behind something and allow them to ask a question, you're showing, you know, a much wider sort of engagement with a much larger community. And that speaks volumes to people. And it also speaks volumes to Google because it can detect, you know, who is sharing that, who's talking about it. By linking your articles or your blogs or even pages on your site via your Twitter account, via your Facebook, you know, Google tracks who shared it. If you've got somebody in your network who shared one of your pages and somebody in their network is searching while logged into Google, Google will actually show, look, one of your friends from Facebook or Twitter shared this article recently. So that's really important because that's going to enable you to get traffic from search engines as well as getting traffic from people who drop by your Facebook or your LinkedIn page.
How important is that social media element nowadays?
It's growing in importance. You know, if somebody... And I'm sure you've experienced a lot of this. If you want to change phones or change cars and you go on Twitter, you'll get a great amount of feedback. You'll certainly be put in touch with a few places to go and search. The types of feedback you get from direct search would be, you know, going to forums, for example, and people will share problems that they've had. It's hard to quantify and measure. And in Google, in analytics, you can actually measure how many people came to your site because of a social engagement. I would say right now the numbers are low, probably 5 to 15% at the high mark. Probably less than 1% for 90% of search is affected by social at the moment. But I expect this will grow a lot over the next 12 months.
David Quay there from Primary Position. That's an extract from a podcast interview which was featured on the Small Business Show, which is a radio show that I produce and present. present with Caelan Kerwin over at a website called focusmeireland.com. As I said, Michaela, it was very much that interview, very much designed for the non-technical person, for the small business owner and people like that. But, you know, just a flavour, I suppose, there of what David was talking about the social search, talking about the fact that you can't really game the system. We refer to the fact that SEO has had something of a snake oil reputation caused by bad practitioners. That's elsewhere in the interview as well. People promising, making really false promises, I suppose, to businesses in terms of what can and can't achieve. At the end of the day, what it comes down to, content is king, relevance is what matters, and the search engines are in the business of making sure that their search results are relevant.
Yeah, and this is something that people tend to overlook. I mean, ultimately, it's like, it's even the same when you're even paying for ads on Google. They cost less when they're more relevant. Mm. Because, you know, what they want, of course, is a better experience for the user. So if people are constantly finding junk when they search on Google, then their experience is going to be bad, and people will stop using Google, which I know sounds crazy, but, you know, there is that risk. Mm. And, you know, that's how Google, one of the ways Google is able to maintain its dominance in search is by constantly tweaking the algorithms. The Panda update was huge. The most recent one, I've just posted a link there in the notes, was one called Penguin. And, you know, what they've been trying to do is to remove all the junk, the meaningless, automatically generated rubbish that doesn't add any value to anything, really. There's a lot going on. I mean, also he mentioned as well the importance of things like Google Plus in search, and that's something that's becoming more and more important. And, you know, people have been saying that, you know, Google Plus is dead, nobody's using it, all this kind of thing. The reality is that you should use it if you're looking at doing any real SEO, because it has an impact on the search results.
It certainly does. The search plus your world, I think, is how Google have branded it as such. But increasingly, you see, when I search for things in Google, I see things come up, for example, that you have tagged on Google Plus or recommended or blogged about in some way.
Oh, yeah. And you're going to see more and more of that. I mean, depending on what you search for, like if I'm going to throw in, say, let me think of a keyword. I'll throw hosting in. Just actually scroll down a little bit, and I can see stuff that I shared and stuff that the Black Knight account shared. Mm. And like earlier today, I was doing a search for something, and yeah, 160 personal results will give me for this one. And actually bring back things like up on the top right above the adverts. It gives you like a highlight of some of the content from your networks and everything else. I mean, you know, the crossover between social and search and everything it's fascinating to watch, and it's an ever-moving target.
And I suppose that people have kind of said that maybe the active use of Google Plus may not be that that impressive, but if you think about it, Google Plus is more than just a site that you visit. It extends its tendrils really into other things, and in particular into Google Search. And I suppose if you consider that the Twitter data isn't going into Google Search, it makes Google Plus all the more important. They're leveraging that. Actually, that's an antitrust issue, isn't it? Isn't there some case about that at the moment?
Yeah, this is something, I'm not sure that we talked about it or whether it was something, I can't remember, but the problem, and it's a danger, is that if you do a search for certain types of things, and specifically I think it was around travel, that because Google and a couple of the others have bought up a lot of the travel-related sites and the sites that do things like handling timetables and search and all that kind of thing, they're going to float to the top a lot faster on Google and a couple of the other sites. Mm. Several of those of the other companies were taking some kind of action against Google, saying that they were involved in anti-competitive practices by using their dominance to basically completely neuter the competition.
We didn't have a guest on the show this week, Michaela. It's just as well. They wouldn't have got a word in.
Oh, we did have a guest. Didn't we have the
Oh, we had the clip from David, and that was actually people heard, if you heard the noise in the background, by the way, that was a cup of coffee I had with David in the West County Hotel in Ennis, County Clare, about 4 weeks ago, actually. So listen, that's it for technology.ie for this week. You can leave comments on the website at technology.ie. I like what you've done, Michele, as well, with the social comments, tying in Facebook, Twitter and all of that in as well, unifying everything, really, in the comments at the bottom of a post.
Yeah, it's a free plugin from the guys in MailChimp. And you know, there's a few of them. I don't know if you remember that when Yoast and a couple of others had released plugins that were doing what was called tweetbacks.
I think I remember, yeah.
Because you remember the way you used to ping backs and track backs and all that kind of thing on blog posts. Yeah. And at one stage they were useful, and then they just became Spam Central.
And then there's been various services over the years, like CoComment, I think, was an Irish one, I think. I don't know if that is still in use or anything like that. But yeah, this whole issue of being able to unify comments across different services and trackbacks and pingbacks and all that, this is one of the best implementations I've seen of it.
It's a nice, it's a not a bad solution. I mean, it's not perfect. Mm. But I mean, I think what it does, and it's something, you know, I like to experiment with these things, is we still retain control over the comments. They're still held on our site. So if we stop using that plugin or whatever, we don't lose all the content. This is not, it's not being stored with a third party. Because a lot of, you'll see blogs are using Discus, and there's a few other ones, I think Livefire, and there's a bunch of others. Mm-hmm. And it's the comments and everything are being supplied by a third party. Whereas this thing, it resides on our side. We still control it. I'm using it on the Black Knight blog. I'm also using it on a couple of my personal blogs. And, you know, it tracks things like tweets that reference the post. And then, of course, people can comment using their Facebook account or their Twitter account. And maybe there might be other options further down the line, depending on what social networks exist.
A particularly good example of it, I think, was a post that you posted, I think, yesterday, which was about Google Easter eggs, which is very cool, and I encourage people to check it out.
Yeah, the two barrel roll thing is very funny. Somebody else posted in the comments about, what was it, the answer, what is the answer to the ultimate question or something, you know, the answer being 42.
And another very subtle thing that that programmers would be interested in, which is recursive. If you Google the word recursive, it says, "Did you mean recursive?" And you can click on that, and it's essentially you're in an infinite loop of recursion. But what I thought was interesting, actually, on that very same post, of course, which is that your tweets, when you then go and tweet about a particular post, when you tweet that you made a particular post and ask people to come and comment on it, that then gets picked up, puts into the comments, and of course that link is then recursive as well. You click on that, you simply load up the same page again. It's cool. It's a geek thing. It's a programmer thing, and it's just the kind of thing we like on technology.ie. We also like comments, whether they're on Twitter or any other way. Do get in touch with us and let us know what you think. But until next week, from myself, Conor Mwinachon, from yourself, Michele Nealon, and bon voyage to you, Michele.
Thanks, Con. Hope to speak to you next week.
All the best. Take care.